Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Last week, I broadcast it live from the FIRE Future in Review Conference that was held at Stein Erickson's Lodge in Park City.
The FIRE, or Future in Review, conference is in its 14th year. The Economist named the Future in Review the best technology conference in the world. Today's show will be comprised of additional interviews that John taped during the conference.
Our first guests are, in fact, a panel representing four biotech firms and a venture capital firm that have all come together for a common cause to treat undiagnosed illnesses.
Our second guest will be Ray Gibbs. He's the CEO of Haydale. It's a graphene provider in the United Kingdom.
Our third guest, Caitlin Cameron, who's the chair and CEO of Otonexus Medical Technologies, and her company has a fascinating new product that will be out soon.
And the fourth guest, Khan Slobodchikov, the CEO and president of Animal Communications, LTD.
Now, Lynn, we spoke with him last year, so this is sort of an update on his device that will allow us to communicate with our domestic dogs. Pretty cool.
I love it.
Yeah. So these four guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of Cool Science Radio. Have you been told you need a total knee or shoulder joint replacement? Information about alternatives is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guests this morning are a panel representing four biotech firms and a venture capital firm that have come together for a common cause to treat undiagnosed illnesses. Here is that taped conversation. We have assembled a panel of experts. Not only are they experts, but they have come together for a common cause, and that common cause is to work on undiagnosed illnesses. And I've heard that maybe 3 or 4 million people are living with these perplexing illnesses that elude definition and treatment. My distinguished panel here with me this afternoon, Kasia Moritz, clinical director and co-founder of the Neurobehavioral Institute. Also, Ryan Taft, senior director of scientific research for an organization called Illumina. Doug Jamieson, who's a CEO of Harris and Harris Group. It's a venture capital firm that invests in a whole bunch of different things, but he's not here as a venture capitalist. He's here as a very interested party. Dr. John Riles is here, president and CEO of Metabolon, organization that leads in phenotyping technology for assessing health. And finally, from my hometown, Boston, Robin Smith, who's CEO of Origin, with an organization that understands and treats rare genetically inherited diseases. Everybody, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kasia, we're going to start with you. Maybe you can define the problem that you all are addressing.
For the past 4 years, we have been making a documentary called Undiagnosed Medical Refugees, and we realized there are millions of people who are medically ill. Some of them are dying from an illness that they don't know what it is. We realize also that those people can't find the proper help. The medical system is not prepared for them. And even more importantly, those people are suffering and their stories are not being told. Their information is not being collected. So when they're no longer here, science missed the opportunity for new discoveries. So we realize that the future of medicine is in the people, it's probably in people that are sick, but we don't know what it is, because that's where we're going to find the new illnesses, the new treatments for many illnesses. And we realize that, you know, it's an epidemic. I think the numbers are much higher than what you even mentioned.
Okay. All right.
The number of people with rare diseases in the U.S., it takes about 7.5 years for a person to be diagnosed with a rare disease. They estimate that 350 million people worldwide suffer from a rare disease. So if you kind of try to get the perspective on only one aspect of undiagnosed patients, the undiagnosed diagnosed patients could be it's a very large group of people because it's composed of people who haven't found a diagnosis yet, people who have a rare disease and are on that lag time looking for a diagnosis, but also are people who have a disease that has not been named yet, has not been discovered. And so we realize that this population is so important to the future of medicine. And we also were sensitized by the families and the people suffering from this condition, these conditions that we don't know what they are. They're all different.
Right.
But together, we wanted to give them an identity, and we call them undiagnosed.
Okay. So there's actually a couple of things going on. There's this tremendous effort, but there's also this wonderful collaboration of a number of different for-profit companies who have taken time to share information and work together. Ryan, if you could tell us, you're with Illumina, if you could tell us about your relationship with Kasia and with everybody here.
Sure. So Illumina is a DNA sequencing technology company. And so we've got some pretty incredible advancements in the last few years, which have taken a genome from something that was kind of intractable. It's 3 billion letters long. How do you get through all of those letters in any
right.
meaningful time to actually being able to sequence a human genome in about 3 days now?
Mm-hmm.
And so we got engaged with Kasia because we have a real interest in patients with rare and undiagnosed genetic conditions. About 80% of individuals with a rare disease, it has a genetic etiology.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kasia and I got connected several years ago now. And we started talking about some of the patients that she was encountering and realized that it was a really natural fit for us to sequence the genomes of these individuals. And we actually put them through our clinical tests. So we actually have a clinical test that's whole genome sequencing. And we sequence the patients and their family members. And we kind of use their family members as internal controls, because
okay.
if the family members aren't sick and the patient is, there's something different in the genetics. But the genetics is very similar between those individuals. And work with her to try and identify the genetic cause of these individuals. And in a few cases, we got some leads. We didn't resolve anything. But I think that led to the next part of the project, which was really, it really does take a community to solve these cases. In many cases, you end up getting a room full of experts. And I think now we're talking about getting together consortiums of companies and academic institutions to try and resolve these cases and really move medicine forward.
And Dr. Riles, Metabolon's involvement in all of this?
Yeah, so our technology, we can look at all the small molecules in a sample, like a blood sample, simultaneously, and that gives us a really unique view on what's happening metabolically to the patient. And like Ryan was saying, many of these have a genetic base, but in the end, the disease is manifest as a change in metabolism. And
mm-hmm.
so where it may be difficult to get a genetic, a clear genetic signal that is leading to the disease, we can actually see metabolically what the disease is. And so I think what pulled us into this is we had been doing chronic fatigue syndrome patients, and we had actually had a lot of success in identifying what was happening with a chronic fatigue syndrome patient and how to treat them, and then got connected with Kasia, and that's, you know, we started listening to the undiagnosed disease story and thought, well, of course we need to try, and
right.
we need to see what we can do. And so we actually had quite a lot of luck, I think, with most of these patients, and so... You know, time will tell, because we're now starting to work through the therapies, but you know, we think we have identified some of the causes.
Mm-hmm. And Robin Smith, your organization, name of the company is Origin, has a way of being able to replace the trial and error guesswork and being able to diagnose and treat through all these blood samples that you take. Maybe you can take a minute and talk about that, and then tell us the value that you've added to working on this problem with everybody else.
Yeah, so Origin is a regenerative medicine company. We focus on taking human blood samples and then reprogramming those back to induced pluripotent stem cells. So these are cells that are equivalent of 3 days old, and they are immortalized in our laboratory. And what we can do with those cells is we can use those cells for extracting DNA for genetic testing. We can also take those cells and differentiate them into different tissues of the body. So, for instance, if we recovered some blood from a patient with a genetically inherited heart condition like long QT syndrome or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, we could actually grow their heart tissue in our lab, and we can test stuff on their heart tissue. Those tissues actually start beating spontaneously in a lab, too. So from their blood, we can actually grow beating heart cells in our laboratory and then test what types of treatments or therapies may work well on that and actually measure the responses. So as part of this process for the past couple of years, we've been out actually crowdsourcing blood samples from around the United States and around the globe. So we have this really expanded infrastructure for going out and collecting blood samples in remote locations, at concerts, at marathons, at various different areas. And when we were talking about this undiagnosed disease problem, there was this idea of getting a bunch of companies together to analyze these samples, but every company needs a slightly different type of blood sample taken and a slightly different type of process made, and including microbiome, which are swabs for fecal swabs. And those need to be frozen for a while and collected for up to a month. So I just raised my hand and said, why don't we just go out and get their blood? why don't we show up at their house and with a phlebotomist to make it easy for those patients? And that was absolutely fascinating. It was a fascinating logistics problem, but it was also really a heartwarming experience for our staff to actually be in these people's homes, working with them on collecting the samples, and then the patients actually opening up their kitchen to let us do things like centrifuge blood samples in their kitchens, which was a fascinating. We can tell long, long stories about that process too. It was a great experience for us, and we're thankful to be involved with the project and being on that end of helping. And then on the back end, later, as we have those samples and we're growing those tissues in our lab, we think we'll be able to investigate more and more different either treatment options or even measure what's going on phenotypically with those cells.
Okay. Your organization is in Seaport in Boston. And so if there was somebody in Park City that was having some sort of heart problem and it was undiagnosed and you took the blood from there, what you're saying is that the blood would be sent to you in Boston without even meeting with the patient. You could observe the beating pattern of their heart after the stem cells start replicating themselves as heart cells.
Correct. That's correct. So we have heart's a great example because you can see it and you can measure it. So it's a really great demonstrable example of this. So yeah, we have long QT patients from England. We have patients from the U.S. and we have incubators filled with their little beating heart cells in petri dishes, where we can measure the response based on different drug combinations, different pacemaker settings, different therapies, and they actually really recapitulate the disease state that the patient has, which is also it's fascinating.
Yeah. Doug Jamieson on the venture capital side. Typically, when a venture capital sits down with you, we're talking money, but that's not necessarily the case here, is it?
No. So two other things we do, right? So we get to be in the blessed position that we spend our life looking at the next great transformative emerging technologies and the people doing that work on a daily basis. And so we get to see what's out there, what's up and coming, and what are the technologies that could solve some of these problems as applied to undiagnosed disease. The other thing we do as venture investors is we're facilitators, and that was exactly our role in the UNDX consortium. So Katya and I, last year here in Park City, we were talking about the Clarity Undiagnosed project that Katya was doing, that Illumina was involved in, and we started asking the question, is what other contextual information could we gather that might help these patients? And in my role, I'd spent a lot of years looking at some of that contextual information. We've been involved probably about 5 to 7 years. We watched the rise of the genomic era. We watched Illumina, who is the world's leading company in that space, and we started looking at, if all of this keeps developing, what are the other technologies that are going to help solve these problems? And we've gotten involved in that space. And so Katya asked me as we started, we said, let's form this. Let's go after this challenge and see if we can provide this information. She then asked me, what technologies do we want to bring together for this? So I worked with Katya. We formed the organization, the UNDX Consortium. We then helped her bring together some of the technologies for it as well. We actually have supported that organization. But I have to tell you, the companies we work with did all the work really pro bono. They used their time and energy to do all of this. And then we brought everybody together in San Diego so we could share those results on August 15th and 16th.
Yeah.
So we're a clear facilitator.
I have to tell you all, the last 3 years we've been doing Cool Science Radio, there's been one common theme, and that's that the old standalone islands of people working themselves. And because we historically go back and look at the innovators, who are the science and who are the technology people that help bring us to where we are today, and looking at the way it used to be and looking at the way it is now, there's a lot more collaboration going on, and it's very exciting. And the government was not even involved in this. You all got together yourselves and did this.
Yeah. It's really unusual, and I think that's the way science is going to move forward, is because I think we need each other to make this happen, and I think patients have to be advocates. So I'm very lucky because I come from both sides. I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm a PhD, and at the same time, you know, 6 years ago I became sick, and I've been an undiagnosed patient, for the past 6 years, and I realize that patients have to advocate, and it's through our advocacy that we're going to reach the world of science and bring them together, because there's nothing more touching than a real story, right? And that's why the documentary is so important. And when we told our stories to these companies, those companies did not care about anything else other than we need to help them. And I have to tell you, they really did everything. I can't tell you how many times I call those guys on a weekend and say one of our patients is struggling with something, and they try to come together and give us more technology and more testing. And I have to tell you, it's been the most heartwarming experience for me as a patient, as a doctor, as an advocate, that these companies are collaborating, and not only that, they are thinking of the patient, they are thinking of the future of medicine through this collaboration, and it's fascinating to see. And I think they're enjoying also, because we learn so much from one another. I've learned a ton in this process. It's been amazing. Yeah.
And for our listeners, what do you need to complete your documentary?
We need money. That's for
sure.
That's
it, money.
We need money. So, you know, people don't realize that to make a documentary, you're not making money. You're putting your own money.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I've been working a lot of extra hours so we can fund the movie. I think that for us to get to our outreach, we're going to need about $800,000 to complete the entire movie. But the nice thing about it is the Undiagnosed Consortium, the UNDX that we call consortium, is already our outreach. So we already have other companies interested in joining us, so our goals are already being achieved. Now we need to finish the movie so the movie could go and be in front of the audience. That's what we were looking for.
Okay. Dr. Riles, what is metabolomics? Metabolomics, excuse me.
Metabolomics, but
sorry.
What it is, it's a technology where we can measure all the small molecules all at the same time.
Okay.
And so we can take a blood sample, for example, and we can look at all those molecules that are involved in metabolism. And these are things that will create energy. They're the things that create larger molecules. You know, so it's basically the essence of how you survive.
And how many small molecules do we all have, and what's the significance of that?
Well, nobody knows exactly for sure, but it's probably right in the order of 2,000 to 2,400 molecules that everybody would have. And, you know, and we can tell that because we know how many enzymes are in the genome, and that's all we can really figure out. And that's all that we see.
And the importance of identifying small molecules?
Well, it's really important to identify what they are and how they're, because we know how they interact. You know, this is the result of 150 years of biological science, you know, starting in the 1880s, where people were understanding what these molecules were, and then they would understand how they work in pathways, and then how those pathways interact to cause disease or to keep a patient healthy.
Okay. You know. Before we button up, I want to throw this open. If anybody else has anything to say about your collaboration or about the piece that you're providing or any other ideas that you may have.
I wanted to pick up on a thread, what you mentioned there, which was that you're seeing this breakdown of silos and people collaborating more together. And I just wanted to add to that, that I think the other barrier that's breaking down, to Katya's point and actually Robin's point, is the barrier between patient and clinician.
Yes.
And patient and researcher. And that's one of the things I think that really made this work so well, is you had the patients themselves directly engaged. And I think as we talk about true precision medicine, that voice of the patient becomes more and more important. We just saw this on Capitol Hill. There was a drug called Sarepta for patients with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and it just got approved because those patients went to Capitol Hill and lobbied directly for its approval. And so we can discuss whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. There's arguments on both sides, but I think the important thing is that it's not just scientists and companies collaborating, it's the collaboration between the patients themselves and those trying to help them, and
good
really
point.
And really embracing that relationship.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, I think one of the things that we see as we're collecting tens of thousands of samples every weekend out there in the public is that people and patients want direct access to information about themselves. And for some reason, as a society, we've gotten to this mode where we have to ask for our information from a third party. And I think that whole world has got to end at some point. My analogy that I use is if you think back about how the internet grew, you could do an internet search today, and you can do it directly. But if you wanted to do a search on your own genomics, you have to go see somebody called a genetic counselor and get a prescription to actually understand what's going on. And I couldn't imagine a world today where I'd have to go and see a Google counselor to do a query and search on data and information. So I think that's going to open up, and it's opening up overseas. It's not opening up as much in the United States as it is in other regions. So I think that's an important aspect for both all the patients and consumers and the general public to really start thinking seriously about their information should be accessible by them. And I think that's an important we shouldn't treat people like they're not intelligent enough to handle it. I think they want it, and we see that every day.
Okay. Kasia, Dr. Riles, Doug, anything else?
I'd say just looking forward. So this was really a grassroots effort, and it was amazing from the patient's perspective. We had clinicians there too. You know, clinicians actively want to learn and get this information. Clearly, we had the technologists. We had people there, biostatisticians, that can interrogate different data sets so that you can understand how the different information is working together or not working together. But one of the things we did at the end of it is we said, this is really a beginning. What's next? And I think a few things came out of that. First of all, I think there are a lot of other technologies that can be brought into this, into the future, to work to help answer these questions. Two, there are clearly other patients that would like to be involved and get this information. And so how do we bring them into it? I think three is, you know, technologically moving forward, how do we bring the different data sets together? How do we bring in the statisticians, the engineers that can look at this different data and provide a clinically relevant output from it? And then the last piece I think is really important is healthcare in America is still, I mean, we're trying to break down these boundaries, but it's still run by clinicians. And so there's a huge chasm between the technology that is created, sequencing by Illumina, by metabolomics, by epigenetic technology, and how do we bridge that with the clinicians? And I think that's a huge next step. And if we're successful there, I think we really accelerate not just precision medicine and health, but we start accelerating answers to these undiagnosed patients down from 7.5 years.
We have to empower the patient as well, because one of the things that we realize when you're undiagnosed and you're really on the edge of that, nobody knows what you have, and you have used all the technologies that currently exist. Anything that is done in terms of new tests, your doctors don't understand either. So when I come up to them with this like chromosomal rearrangement, they looked at me like I have two heads. And the idea is we all on this together in many ways. And so that the patient actually, if you have my chart where you can actually access at the same time the blood test results with your doctor, you're accessing at the same time, what is the difference between that and the new technologies, right? And so the new technologies for me are the most important aspect of what we need to do next. And I had created this little mathematical equation in my mind, which was, you know, collaboration plus new technologies equals hope. And this is what we wanted for all our families, is that they have access to new technology and the collaboration, not only the collaboration of the companies, but the collaboration of our community equals our hope in the future for diagnosis and treatment and actually for the advancements in medicine.
Hope is pretty strong, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah,
keeps us going, right?
Kasia Moritz, clinical director, co-founder of Neurobehavioral Institute. Ryan Taft, Senior Director of Scientific Research for Illumina. Doug Jamieson, CEO of Harris & Harris Group, a venture capital firm. Dr. John Riles, President and CEO of Metabolon. And, from Boston again, go Pats, Robin Smith, CEO of Origin. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. Okay.
And again, that was John Wells with a panel of experts and CEOs from the FIRE Conference, the Future in Review Conference, that took place last week, held at Stein Erickson Lodge right here in Park City. Our next guest is Ray Gibbs, the CEO of Haydale. It's a graphene provider in the United Kingdom. And here is that taped conversation also from last week's Future in Review Conference.
I'm sitting down with Ray Gibbs, who's the CEO of Haydale Industries. And Ray, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Good to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, we spoke a year ago, and it was a fascinating conversation about your company and graphene products and possible applications. And I was really looking forward to coming back a year later and see how you're doing.
We're doing good, thank you. We just announced our results to the end of June 2016. They're in line with the market. We've just acquired a business in South Carolina, Greenville, so we're setting up in the U.S. So it's part of our global expansion. And today we launched 3D printing filaments with graphene in them in Birmingham in U.K.
Okay. And what is it about the U.K.? They seem to have sort of the leg up on others.
Well, the UK was where graphene was first isolated by two Russian scientists in Manchester. The government backed a plan to invest into graphene in Manchester and put a National Graphene Institute together. And that, of course, takes materials evaluation only between TRL, which is technical readiness level, between 2 and 3, and you need 9 to get to an end product.
Okay.
And that's where we come in with the NGI.
Yeah. And just give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of the sophistication of the process in making these products.
Well, we don't make graphene per se. We get it from the marketplace. The thing I would say to you is that every single person's material is all different. Mm-hmm. So you need to understand what it is the material does, how it looks, how it performs, the chemical groups on the surface of the material, because they are the groups that interact with the materials you're trying to put it into, a resin, a polymer, an ink system. And the sophistication of what we do, if I could explain, this material, a single sheet of graphene is 64 angstroms thin or thick. Now, if you added 3 million layers of this stuff together, end on end on end, you would have that 1 millimeter thick.
Oh. Well, wow. Pretty
so
precise.
That just tells you how, and we're looking for flake sizes on the graphene of between 3 to 5 microns. A micron is 1 millionth of a meter.
Okay.
So this is really small stuff.
Yeah. And what are some of the applications that the product is being used for today? And looking into the future, next 5, 6 years, what sort of applications in the future?
Well, we're into the here and now, really. Lots of people hype up graphene, big style. What we're trying to do is put it into the composite world, and by that I'm looking at adding it into resins. We work with and have announced a collaboration with Huntsman, who actually started life in Salt Lake City. That's where John Huntsman started the business.
That's right.
And it's a $10 billion operation worldwide, and we're working with the guys in Switzerland, and we're adding our materials into their resins. It's an araldite resin. For those of you technically, it's an araldite resin. It's high-end epoxies glue, and we're adding it in to make it thermally conductive, which means it's managing heat very well. Now, if I can explain, when you're putting this stuff into a tool, a composite tool, for example, because when you make a composite part, you need the female part to be there that actually makes the real one. So heating that up into an oven, which is what you need to do to create the cure for the composite part itself. Normally, that tool has carbon fiber and a resin attached to the outside. That's a polymer-based system. When you heat it up to 150, 200 degrees C, the carbon fiber strands don't move. The coefficient of expansion is nil. The polymer absolutely does. So over time, that base tool becomes out of shape.
Yeah.
So your end composite material that you're trying to make, it becomes out of sync from what you started life. And so adding graphene manages the heat, so you can heat the tool up quicker, cools down quicker, increases throughput.
And will graphene always be added to something else, or will it ever stand on its own?
If you're Samsung, you're trying to make it stand on its own and spending $100 million trying to make a single sheet to attach to the front of your iPhone and change ITO, indium tin oxide. We're not in that game. But we're trying very hard to put this into things like ink systems. Let me explain that. We're adding our materials into ink to create a biomedical sensor,
mm-hmm.
and that is an additive manufacturing. You put these layers of ink onto a sheet. Very clever diagnostics. And what that does is, if you put a piece of some blood onto the surface, you end up with diagnosing whether that's got insulin issues for diabetes or the likes of that. Currently, all of those sensors are made using silver, which is expensive, toxic, and not recyclable. Adding graphene into this creates the ability to do that, so that sensor is not a throwaway, it's a recyclable product at the end.
Okay. All right, good. Is this your second or third year to the fire
conference?
I'm here,
this is my second year.
Yeah.
Because you had me last year and predicted that we would be bought by now. Well, we're not. We're still here, sir. We're still here.
What did we bet anyway? I forget.
I can't remember.
Dinner or something?
Yeah, I think it was.
I don't know what it was. I just thought you'd be acquired. I thought it was so hot.
Well, we're fighting hard to keep that independence. And we are quoted on the stock exchange in the UK. We've raised some money. We bought a business in South Carolina, Greenville, which is into silicon carbide. Now, that's interesting. Why silicon carbide? Well, when you add graphene to silicon carbide, you have a different, what we call a carbon-carbon system, and that works really well in brakes.
Okay. All right.
And also this business itself, it's got a system where it adds a silicon carbide into a Teflon coating to create, for those of you who are cookware fans, a scratch-resistant Teflon coating for your pots and pans.
That's truly scratch resistant.
Mm-hmm. Certainly is. Yeah.
There's a tremendous application for that, because every pot or pan I've ever bought that had some surface that could not be scratched, it didn't take very long.
No, it peels away, right?
I don't know if it's the product or the way I cook, but this is something that will not scratch.
Yes.
And what value would the silicon carbide graphene product that would go into automobile brakes, what value would that provide? Is it more cost effective? Is it
improves performance, longevity? Mm-hmm. The industry itself is looking to have a brake pad system that is the life of the car.
Okay,
and it's not at the moment. And this is, we've had it tested, or the company had it tested some while ago in Germany, and it's improved the performance of the current brake systems by about 60 or 70%. So we're looking to do some of that in the marketplace as soon as we can.
Okay. As far as the fire conference goes, I was at the opening reception last night, and I was just thinking, how many of the people in this reception over the next 4 days are going to be meeting each other, collaborating, sharing ideas? I mean, it's really a powerful couple of days, isn't it?
It is. I actually met a guy over dinner who was and still is heavily involved in analytics.
Mm-hmm.
And adding analytics into composite materials means that you can get diagnostic checks done properly. We have a process where we're looking at doing pipes, oil and gas pipes. And if you get the right analytics because of the graphene in the pipe, you can diagnose where there's some change in the resistivity of the pipe, i.e. a break. And you can pinpoint that down.
Okay.
Or you can make things very much more interactive and intelligent, which is quite stunning.
Okay. Ray Gibbs, who is the CEO of Haydale Industries, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Yeah, John Wells for Cool Science Radio. And we should probably get together next year and see how things are going.
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
I'm sure we will.
Sounds good.
I love it here. Thank you.
Thanks.
Again, Ray Gibbs with our very own John Wells at last week's Future in Review conference. Stay with us. We'll be back with more taped interviews from that conference. This is Cool Science Radio.
The Spur and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open Thursday through Saturday nights with dinner, drinks, and live music. The SpurBarAndGrill.com includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art & Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art & Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We continue our taped conversations from the FIRE Future in Review Conference that was held last week at Stein Erickson's Lodge in Park City. Our third conversation this morning is with Caitlin Cameron, who is the chair and CEO of Otonexus Medical Technologies. I sat down with her at last week's Future in Review Conference, and here's that taped interview. And joining me now at the table, and I'm delighted to have her here, is Caitlin Cameron, who's the chair and CEO of Otonexus Medical Technologies, fascinating company. Caitlin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You know, we've spoken a couple of times, and you just have a product that makes so much sense. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. Otonexus has developed an ultrasound medical device for the accurate diagnosis of middle ear infections in kids, also in adults, but the big problem really is in children. Middle ear infections are called otitis media. They are the number one reason for antibiotics in kids and the number one reason for surgery in kids. Yet clinical studies show that doctors get it wrong about 50% of the time, particularly in the key differentiation of antibiotic versus no antibiotic. In primary care, it's very difficult to tell. You can generally tell the presence of infection, but not type of infection. Our device uses ultrasound in a completely novel way to determine not only presence of middle ear infection, but also type of infection so that the clinician can instantly make the differentiating decision of whether or not to prescribe an antibiotic.
And you know what's interesting? Tell me if you think this is right or not, but I think oftentimes from my own experience, you have a child, the child is sick. You're a parent, you're very concerned about the child. You're in with the pediatrician, for an example, and the pediatrician may or may not be able to ascertain if the eardrum is in fact infected. Yet, because the parent is there in the office and kind of pressuring the pediatrician to come up with some sort of prescription for antibiotics to do something, this might mitigate some of that, because as the diagnosis comes in immediately and definitively states binary, yes or no, bacterial, it says no, then there's no reason at all to write a prescription, is there?
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, just because of that situation and because of the very significant consequences of undertreatment, including permanent hearing loss, you see massive overprescription of antibiotics in this space. And the parental pressure, as you can imagine, the screaming child in pain, please do something to fix it, has also led to pressure for antibiotics. So the ability to have a definitive answer, to clearly be able to state, absolutely, this is an infection that will not respond to antibiotics, or this is an infection that does need antibiotics. And, oh, by the way, the device itself has screens and information that you can help, that can help the pediatrician or other caregiver share that information with the parent and talk to the parent about what the actual situation is and what is the proper course of action.
And, Caitlin, speaking of the device, with the exception of the LCD screen, which is a couple inches by a couple inches, it looks exactly like what my pediatrician used when she would check my ears when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I'm pretty old. So, so
that device hasn't changed
much
in 80 years.
It was a long time ago. So your device looks just like that. And I believe it's still in prototype, and and that you'll probably have a product out in how long, you think?
We're just about a year away from market launch.
Okay.
So we are in prototype phase. We're completing a final development, and then we've got a, we believe, pretty short FDA path to clearance, and we'll be in market next year. But you're right. This device is specifically designed to look and feel and be used just the same as the otoscope, which is a tool primarily used for diagnosis today. Y'all know the otoscope. You go into the doctor, shine a light in your otoscope. It's a visual inspection of the outside of the eardrum and an attempt to guess what's going on the outside, on the other side of that eardrum. And so we did that intentionally to, number one, make it very comfortable and fast and easy and just fit very easily into the flow of the physician practice. And number two, it really doesn't require any training at all. If you
That's
can use
right.
an otoscope, you can use this device as well.
Yeah, fascinating. Will a single pediatrician in a single office be able to afford this device, or is this more for office of several pediatricians?
Yeah, it's actually very specifically designed for the small pediatrician or the large either one, and in fact for use just about anywhere in the world. It's designed to be an inexpensive, easy to use device that is just very, very simple and straightforward and gives you the straightforward answer. In the United States, we're also helped by the fact that we in fact have reimbursement against this device. So in fact, for a pediatrician, it's an unusual situation where they could actually make money using the device. By using the testing. But the key is, what the pediatricians really care about is they want to comply with the new guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrician to reduce antibiotics. but they have no tools.
Right.
They have no good tools. And this gives them a tool to definitively determine whether or not an antibiotic is appropriate.
And we were speaking yesterday, and you were telling me about the challenge of developing this, because most ultrasound products use a gel to make contact and then be able to ascertain
whatever. Gel coupling, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is to operate through air.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. One of the key things that we did, we developed an absolutely unique ultrasound transducer that works through air in order to do this differentiation. And that's because you go in to see a doctor for an ultrasound, they will put gel on your skin. It's called gel coupling. But trust me, you don't really want to put gel inside of a child's ear, much less dig it back out. So we've developed a unique ultrasound transducer that works through air.
Okay. And the name of your company, OtoNexus Medical Technologies, is plural technology. So are there other applications? Are there other products that may follow this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This technology is very special. This ultrasound transducer and the related technologies clearly are very applicable to otitis media or middle ear infections. First and foremost, that's our focus, to get that out onto the market and be successful with it. But the ultrasound technology that we've developed is unique and has many other medical applications. One, for instance, might be a vastly superior glaucoma test, no-touch glaucoma test, and a variety of other technologies behind that as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio, and best of luck with your company and your product, Caitlin.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And that, again, was Caitlin Cameron, the chair and CEO of OtoNexus Medical Technologies. And John, wow, that must have been really exciting. The entire Future in Review conference that you attended while I was out of town, unfortunately, boy, very enriching. And all the conversations there are about cutting edge medical, you know, biotech, technology. What else?
Yeah, I was sitting at dinner the first night, and the guy that runs all the small satellite programs from NASA was on one side of me, and the gentleman that's responsible for the International Space Station was on the other side of me, and everybody at the table. And the interesting thing about this conference, this is the 14th year again, second year in Park City, is that there is so much going on during the planned presentations that they have in the sharing of information. And they also work on problems together and, you know, that sort of thing. And there's no PowerPoint presentations. This is all just talking, which is really refreshing. But out in the lobby, out in the hallways, there's all this sharing of information because all of these people have come in from all around the world, and they're just jazzed to be there and very enthusiastic about what they're doing in their lives, but also very interested in what other people are doing. And you could see the gears turning. You could see things happening as they were sharing their stories and sharing information and starting to collaborate.
Ah, the energy there. And really, you know, as we've talked about on this show, Cool Science Radio, before, the collaboration that you see between different camps of science, different fields in science, that's what's making the exponential discovery of these cutting-edge technologies. That's what's pushing it ahead. That's the nexus, is the collaboration, and to come together for the Future in Review conference simply, it sounds like, is a massive brainstorming session and a sharing and then a collaboration. It's incredible.
Yeah. After 4 days, I was on overload. I mean, I had so many conversations
with
so many people. Oh, it was fantastic. And back to your point, you know, these silos that used to exist of islands of people that be working on their problems individually, that not only are they collaborating today with people within the same discipline, but all these multi-disciplines. You know, you've got biologists talking to chemists, talking to astrophysicists, talking to material handling people, talking to packaging people. I mean, the whole thing is just incredible.
Right. Now, were there any other public radio people at the conference?
BBC Radio was there. They have an audience of 160 million people.
Kind of like us.
Kind of like But BBC was there for the entire week, and then there were a number of television crews that came in from various entities.
Right. So to our listeners, if you're interested in hearing more of this, well, not only will today's show, as every Cool Science Radio show, is archived on kpcw.org, but if you're interested in looking further, go to BBC and just do a search on Future in Review Conference Park City, and And you'll get to, no doubt, hear more because you didn't get to talk to everyone there, although you spoke and interviewed, what, 10 different people, dozen
people?
Right,
and there's a number of people that I'll be following up with that we didn't have time to tape an interview or there was a conflict somewhere in a session that they were attending. But we will be doing that over the course of the next couple of months. And similar to last year, as the Future in Review folks bring people into Park City for tech talks to talk about what they are up to, we'll be speaking with them and bring them into Cool Science Radio. So we have a nice relationship, Cool Science Radio and the management team of the fire people.
Right. And not only that, but other groups like the Park City Institute get to Terry Orr, no doubt, went up to the Future in Review conference just to see, gosh, who could we get to come back to Park City once they come here, you know, during the fall? Of course they want to come back during the winter and give a little talk over in the Black Box Theater. That's a great series as well.
And just one final thing, Lynn, if anybody missed the program last week, it was broadcast live from the conference, and we had Bebop Gresta on the program, and he is the chair and the chief operating officer for Hyperloop Transportation Technologies, which, if you haven't heard of it, think of a small pod with people in it in a near frictionless environment that travels in a tube at 600 to 650 miles per hour, Los Angeles to San Francisco in less than 35 minutes.
Elon Musk's brainchild that he then sort of parsed it out to whoever wanted to take it up and could come up with the design, the technology.
As if he had nothing else to do. SpaceX, Tesla, Solar City. Oh, yeah, I think I'll do a 600-page white paper this weekend on a new transportation system that will change the way the world transports.
Yeah, what a guy.
and that thing in Los Angeles to San Francisco is not up and running. They're just testing products right now.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of future hope there.
That's right. Well, we have one more taped interview that you conducted last week. Our final guest is Khan Slobodchikov. He's the CEO and president of Animal Communications LTD. Now, have you ever wanted to communicate with your dog? I know the answer to that. You want to talk to Porkchop, don't you?
I do.
And we all do. You know, this is reality. Khan is working on a product that does just that. And we spoke with him last year at the Future in Review conference. John spoke with him last week, and here's the update on that technology.
Joining me at the table right now is Khan Slobodchikov, who's the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. He's CEO of Animal Communications, LTD, and director of the Animal Language Institute. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
It was a fascinating conversation, the work that you've done over the years with prairie dogs to be able to ascertain the different changes in inflections, voice inflections, if a predator is coming, if the predator, I remember from our conversation, was tall or short or maybe heavy set, was a human, was a coyote. It was just fascinating.
Yeah, you remember very well, John.
Yeah, it was just a conversation that I just found so interesting. And also we were talking about your new company or your new project, which was to work with domestic dogs.
Right. Right now we have a problem in this country in the sense that somewhere between 3 to 4 million dogs are euthanized every year in shelters. And the problem is that a lot of times the dogs can't communicate to their people what the dogs want, and the people can't communicate to the dogs what they want. And so this results in what people perceive as behavioral problems, and eventually people give up their dogs, and there aren't enough other people to adopt them, so the dogs get euthanized. So I'm working on a device that would let us talk to dogs, that would let us communicate with dogs in the sense that the dogs could tell the people, you're scaring me, or I want to eat chicken tonight, or I want to go for a walk, or something like that. And the people could say something to the dogs, don't pee on the rug right here.
I definitely want to have that conversation with. You know, dogs every once in a while will eat some grass or something, and they'll get sick to their stomach and possibly throw up. And my dog only throws up on the Oriental. I want to teach my dog to throw up on the hardwood floor. It only happens a couple of times a year, but he always nails that Oriental.
Well, I think that that's sort of an impossible thing for a dog to do, because I found in my experience, I have tiled floors and I have Persian rugs in my house, and the dogs always choose the Persian rugs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is just fascinating because no one has really been able to communicate or been able to understand at the level that you've been able to do. And this all started with your research on prairie dogs?
Yes, it started with my research on prairie dogs. We were able to build a system using artificial intelligence, essentially machine learning, build a system where we could record the vocalizations of prairie dogs, and then the computer could synthesize the sounds and tell us this is a tall, thin man wearing a blue shirt, for example. And then we could also go backwards, potentially, on that and say tall, thin man wearing a blue shirt, and the program would synthesize the sounds and play it back to the prairie dogs,
okay,
and they would respond accordingly. So conceptually, we have done this, and now what I want to do is transfer this to dogs, because there is so much misunderstanding between humans and dogs that there's a lot of grief that comes about. And I just want people to be happy with their dogs and their dogs to be happy with people.
Sure. So how far away are we from a little black box device that would help us with this communication with our dogs?
We're still working on it. It's not necessarily an easy problem, because 80% of dog communication occurs in body language,
mm-hmm,
and 20% occurs in vocalizations. So we need a device that can record the body language changes of dogs. It can also record the vocalizations, put it all together, and then spit out what it means. So we need to have a dictionary of dog body language, we need to have a dictionary of dog sounds, and we need the software to put it all together.
Right. How's the conference going for you?
Conference is great. As usual, it's a wonderful conference. There's a lot of intellectually interesting ideas. The conference organizers have put together a fabulous list of speakers, so it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I'm just amazed, and there's so much collaboration going on. You know, we all got together at the opening reception yesterday afternoon, and by Friday afternoon, there's going to be a lot of conversations that take place and a lot of sharing of ideas.
That's actually, for me, the value of this conference. Well, the value for me is twofold. One is that I find out what's happening in the tech industry that isn't out there yet, but is something that people are planning on doing. And the other is just the collaborations that I can establish with people. For example, in building this device, I can get advice on people how to go about doing some of these types of things, how to get some funding for this,
right,
lots of different things.
Yeah, there's tremendous value at this conference. Khan Shlobachikov, author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. Love to have you on again next year for another update.
Thank you, John.
Khan, great to see you again.
Great to see you, too.
And we'll be right back after this.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And we want to thank Ray Gibbs, Caitlin Cameron, Khan Shlobachikov, and the entire panel of bio firms for that conversation that we had. We also want to thank the management team from the Future and Review Conference for inviting us out to their conference.
And our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Davidson Orthopedic,